This is Thinking About OBGYN with your hosts, Antonia Roberts and Howard Harrell.
Antonia.
Howard.
What are we thinking about on today's episode?
Well, today we're going to talk a little bit more about IVF, or in vitro fertilization, as a continuation of our previous infertility-related topics that we spent 3 whole episodes on. So obviously, upfront, we're not infertility subspecialists, so we can't talk about it on that level. We don't have any clinical experience independently managing IVF cycles. Like, maybe we'll order part of the workup or part of the labs for someone for convenience, but definitely not making any of their treatment decisions or anything like that. And I think with IVF, it's so easy to just want to jump right into questions that essentially get at what are the proposed subcellular mechanisms of how it works. And we just can't go there. We can't answer that stuff, even as interesting as it may be. But I think the benefit of us mere general OBGYNs talking about it here really would be to give a decent, like 5,000 foot view of it, so to speak, and hopefully give listeners a better understanding of what a lot of our patients go through or where they may be heading.
Yeah, and we guide our patients a lot of times through this pathway. And so having a reasonable understanding of what they're doing and what they go through is certainly beneficial. It's also interesting. I had a thought when you said mere generalists. We should do an episode about where we're already planning on doing an episode. That's a hint for the audience.
Yeah.
About generalists versus subspecialists and things like that. It is interesting. In many ways, a good generalist is harder to come by than a good subspecialist. We actually need to know more things to do the job well. That doesn't mean people do, but to do the job well actually requires more knowledge.
Yeah, I'm excited for that episode. But first, what's a thing we do for no reason?
Well, how about getting baseline labs for a patient whose prior pregnancy was complicated by gestational hypertension or preeclampsia?
Okay, I see this all the time. So you mean a patient who comes in who's newly pregnant, she is normotensive, she does not have a diagnosis of hypertension, but she had a prior pregnancy where she either had gestational hypertension or preeclampsia. So a lot of providers will just automatically, as a knee jerk, they'll get a baseline 24-hour urine with total protein and creatinine clearance, as well as baseline platelet levels and liver function levels for patients like this. And they may even throw in other things like a uric acid or LDH if it's part of a pre-made PIH panel, as we call it.
PIH, we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of not using that word anymore.
Yeah, right.
It's interesting. It stands for pregnancy-induced hypertension. So we used to have pregnancy-induced hypertension and pregnancy-induced glucose intolerance, and we replaced those in the late 90s with gestational hypertension and gestational diabetes. And one of the main motivations for that was moving away from pregnancy-induced glucose intolerance as the term for what we now call gestational diabetes, because the acronym for that was PIGI. And unfortunately, ladies would have piggy written at the top of their chart. But we also don't use PIH anymore. But yes, that's what I'm talking about. So we did talk about uric acid levels before in terms of checking those for a person who had hypertension later in the pregnancy and LDH. But yeah, a lot of clinicians will get what they call baseline labs rather thoughtlessly. I think we have to separate out folks who have chronic hypertension who come in for a new pregnancy from those who just have this history of gestational hypertension or preeclampsia from a prior pregnancy. Now, there's no evidence. There's no valid reason to justify getting a baseline 24-hour urine or checking liver function for that matter because of that history. We'll check the platelets anyway as part of a CBC, but we're not doing that intentionally because they have this history of preeclampsia or anything like that. So maybe if they have an independent risk factor like hepatitis or someone you note has 2 or 3 plus proteinuria on multiple DIPUAs, then there might be some thought to that. So we do get these spot urinalyses during pregnancy, several of those. Some people get them at every visit. Maybe that's another thing to talk about. And if you're doing that and you do see proteinuria, as I said, then go ahead and do it. If someone has proteinuria for a different reason, and then later on, if they develop preeclampsia, whether they have a history of preeclampsia or not, by the way, and they have a history of proteinuria during the visits, then if you do need to diagnose them later with preeclampsia, you may have difficulty using the 300 milligrams of protein per 24-hour urine collection as a method of diagnosis. Maybe the patient has some other reason why they leak protein, like a pre-existing glomerulonephritis, for example. So you would do that whether the patient had a history of preeclampsia or not, if you saw that occurring. But for people without pre-existing hypertension, who just have this history of preeclampsia in a prior pregnancy, we don't make any changes on how we diagnose preeclampsia based upon how much protein they might have already leaked or what their pre-existing liver enzymes. So the kind of concept of a baseline level is frivolous.
We are getting baseline labs for people with chronic hypertension, right? That's still recommended.
Well, maybe. So that's a little different. And it depends on what you mean by which lab. So in that case, if someone has pre-existing hypertension, you're assessing whether or not they have end organ damage present. So depending on how long she's had hypertension and what degree of hypertension she's had, she may present in the pregnancy with pre-existing renal dysfunction. So checking a BNP to see what their creatinine is can be useful, and a spot protein to creatinine ratio is usually all you need to rule out end organ damage for the kidneys, and that's actually what the ACOG bulletin says. So even those patients don't explicitly need a 24-hour urine unless the protein to creatinine ratio is abnormal. And that in turn means that the vast majority of women, even with chronic hypertension, won't actually need a 24-hour urine because you'll exclude end organ damage just with that spot ratio. But if they do have pre-existing renal disease, that baseline 24-hour urine becomes useful because we do then look not at 300 milligrams per 24 hours, but at a significant change in the level of proteinuria, so you need to know where they start. And I think that that's where the concept of a baseline level has come from. But we've drifted far away from that to doing 24-hour urines for all patients with hypertension and even those folks who have a history of hypertension in a prior pregnancy.
Yeah, that's coming straight from Practice Bulletin 203, which is from 2019, and it's the one on chronic hypertension. So I'll just review these recommendations from there again for our listeners. For patients that are coming with chronic hypertension early in their pregnancies, these baseline labs per the bulletin should include the liver enzymes, the creatinine, the blood count, and the urine protein evaluation. And those are the same things that we check basically people in triage, for example, that are coming for suspected preeclampsia. That's why we memorize that. Those are the preeclampsia labs. But also in this bulletin, for chronic hypertensives, ACOG recommends serum electrolytes, specifically potassium, also a BUN, the blood urea nitrogen level, and an EKG. And those are not part of our typical PIH panel because they're not part of the diagnostic criteria for preeclampsia, but they are part of the assessment for baseline hypertensive end organ damage. And you notice, this does not include uric acid. We did previously talk about checking uric acid levels back in a different season to evaluate patients for preeclampsia, but I don't think we ever talked about the idea of getting a baseline uric acid in early pregnancy and then seeing if that changes over time in chronic hypertensive. So I think that's the other place where people might be using it to see if they can figure out in a patient, do they have superimposed preeclampsia because their uric acid is going up?
Yeah, we talked about that in episode 4.1. I definitely hear about people doing that, and I've seen it. And there's been a ton of studies over the years. I've looked at this literature. None of it's been very good. But in that case, you'll check the uric acid of the patient with chronic hypertension per the theory, and then use that baseline number as a reference later on to see if they're getting worsening kidney function, because that's essentially what's happening, is the uric acid there is just a surrogate for decreased renal function. But we don't have any developed diagnostic criteria from the multiple studies that have been done on this that tell us whether the patient has superimposed preeclampsia based on some change or some threshold of change in uric acid. But we do have renal function, things like the serum creatinine of greater than 1.1 or greater, or the creatinine clearance 24 hours, and the amount of protein that we are checking. And those parameters are well defined for what constitutes preeclampsia or what changes in them relative to baseline constitute superimposed preeclampsia, whereas uric acid doesn't. So again, it's just unnecessary. And the thing from the bulletin that you mentioned too, again, when I talk a lot about thoughtless medicine versus sort of thoughtful medicine, but the thoughtful approach that you're doing is you're assessing whether or not this patient has end organ damage. So all of a sudden, the EKG and those other things obviously become sort of common sense if you think about it for a minute. But these other things just aren't helpful.
I can sort of understand the creep of starting to treat prior preeclamptics at their new OB visit as if they were the same thing as a chronic hypertensive, because they do have a higher risk of developing preeclampsia compared to someone who didn't have preeclampsia before. We also know they're at higher risk of future cardiovascular disease. And we know that one of the possible diagnostic criteria for preeclampsia with severe features is that creatinine either more than 1.1 milligrams per deciliter or doubling from the baseline. So this is one of the things where the baseline could come into play. So the provider might think, if you get a baseline in this person who has an elevated risk of becoming preeclamptic, then maybe you can catch her when she develops it later in her pregnancy, but maybe her creatinine is double the baseline, but it's not over 1.1 yet, but you can still catch her.
Yeah, that's a nice theory, but unfortunately, there's no evidence for it. And the thing is, if you're doubling the creatinine of a pre-existing creatinine that gets you above 1.1, you had pre-existing kidney disease. So we're already assessing for that, essentially. And you're not going to develop renal disease from a few weeks or months of hypertension during a pregnancy. This just takes years of hypertension. So yeah, the patient who you're talking about with prior preeclampsia or HELLP or eclampsia, some variant, is definitely at higher risk of developing preeclampsia in her next pregnancy or future pregnancy. So that's why we give low-dose aspirin. That's why we are conscientious about her frequency of visits and things like that. That's it. If she previously developed it before 34 weeks with severe features, then we would screen her for antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. But what's the benefit of the baseline lab in a patient who's not hypertensive currently? And so understanding what normal creatinines are during pregnancy is important for that for a normal person. It's probably going to be 0.4 or less. Usually it's never above 0.5 in a woman who's already pregnant. So let's say her baseline is 0.4, then it goes up to 0.9 when you check it again at 35 weeks. And by that criteria alone, you're going to diagnose severe preeclampsia and deliver her early. And you pat yourself on the back because without those baseline labs, you would have needed her creatinine to reach 1.2 before making the diagnosis. So I think we lost some of the point there that if someone's baseline creatinine is 0.8, you wouldn't use 1.1 and you would use 1.6 instead. But somebody who's 0.8 probably already has pre-existing kidney disease that we would pick up from another reason like history or other labs. But it could happen where you double the smaller creatinine, but that's not going to be sufficient evidence for you to treat the patient differently. That's not going to be the diagnostic criteria that you hang her on. So average creatinines definitely in relation to pregnancy have been studied, and the mean levels are for a woman gets pregnant around 0.67, and then they drop by 16 weeks to closer to 0.5. So if you wait for the average patient to get to 16 weeks and then check baseline labs and it's 0.5 and then it doubles to 1.06, then basically you're getting roughly to where you see that 1.1 comes from anyway. And that's assuming there are no other features of preeclampsia with severe features for you to go off of. So have you saved her life? Have you done something magnificent because you detected, you know, mild blood pressure patient with no other features, but her creatinine is 1.06 and, you know, you're going to deliver her baby and put it in the NICU 3 weeks early? That is not the spirit of any of that criteria or research. So there's just no evidence that this practice has any clinical benefit. And none of the other diagnostic criteria like liver enzymes, platelets, things like that, take into account some baseline. Although obviously we know that if someone has ITP, for example, and she runs 90 all the time, we're not going to use platelets under 100,000 as our clinical criteria. Or if someone has chronic hepatitis, we're not going to even have the upper limit normal to diagnose HELLP syndrome. So we do use our clinical reasoning and think about those margin cases, but it's not a reason to do it routinely, and it's just not science-based. We have a ton to talk about for IVF. So let's jump in.
Okay. There was an article in the March 2023 Green Journal that discussed the implications of abortion bans on prenatal genetic screening and testing. And this article suggested that people might be compelled to seek IVF earlier on in their family building journeys if they knew that legally they wouldn't be able to terminate a genetically abnormal pregnancy, but legally they could still decline to implant a genetically abnormal frozen embryo. Because for now, of course, even in the most strict interpretations in the United States, a pregnancy is still defined as an embryo in the uterus. So if it's outside the uterus, then there's no personhood-related penalties for terminating that embryo.
For now.
So if they get tested and there are significant abnormalities, a lot of clinics' policy is up front. We discard these embryos because they're not gonna survive anyway. So who knows? IVF may become something we see more of, whether it's for that reason or for other reasons. And we already at baseline see plenty of patients for any for routine OBGYN care who either may eventually go down the route of IVF or they already have attempted that or have successfully gone through that. So I think it can help to understand some of the specifics to help us relate better, especially to those patients, and just to know that it's got its own unique struggles. It's a weird, unique world and sometimes lots of stress and uncertainties.
I think the biggest thing that we as generalists and patients for that matter who need a cursory knowledge of this can do is just understand the indications. I think for IVF in particular, where you see it abused sometimes is just overutilization. So knowing when it's appropriate and what other treatments beforehand, which we talked about already in some detail, I think is a big part of it. But IVF has been one of the defining aspects of the reproductive endocrinology and fertility subspecialty since its existence. It's really its own world, its own rabbit hole to dive down, where people probably have a lot of incorrect ideas about it before they actually experience it in real life. Unfortunately, there's almost no clinical guidance now from ACOG about basic infertility assessments or management, let alone more complex scenarios. And so almost everything, even guidance that's directed at the primary women's health provider, comes from ASRM, which is what we based a lot of our prior episodes on. And I wouldn't expect every OBGYN, let alone primary care folk, to subscribe or pay membership due to ASRM to read that guidance, although thankfully a lot of it's free. So even though we're not approaching this from the aspect of a fellowship-trained REI expert, and even though we have to look outside of our main specialty societies for this guidance, I agree that it's definitely worthwhile to understand as much as possible to help guide patients down this pathway and avoid some of the pitfalls and maybe unnecessary cycles that are thrown at them, and help the patients understand IVF better as well.
Yeah, and we talked about pop culture misrepresentations previously about pregnancy and birth, so that's definitely true for IVF as well. We were watching through the series Friends again recently, and we came to the episode where Phoebe agrees to be the gestational carrier or surrogate for her brother's babies. They don't say why exactly, but the implication is that the brother's wife is too old to carry a pregnancy, which I feel like that's problematic, but okay.
And just for the listeners, we does not mean Howard and Antonia. I watched the series when it was new, but I'm a little bit older. So yeah, and I doubt that in that episode that they use donor eggs because they're not actually donated for free. They're purchased at a huge cost. I have seen women over 50 carry pregnancies that they conceived many years earlier by in vitro and had frozen eggs before, embryos before. There are obviously more risks to a pregnancy at a later maternal age, but it's not in itself a contraindication. I think the record is 67 or something in France where a grandmother acted as a surrogate for her infertile granddaughter. But let's give Friends the benefit of a doubt and assume that somehow either she had multiple good eggs of her own despite her age, or maybe she had had eggs frozen in the past and now there's some real reason she can't carry a pregnancy. Maybe she has a uterine anomaly or Asherman's, or it had a hysterectomy for some reason, or a prior loss from severe IEGR or very early HELLP syndrome, or some medical problem with a pregnancy that would make sense for her to maybe have a surrogate, maybe antiphospholipid antibody syndrome.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of legitimate reasons that someone either should not or cannot carry a pregnancy. But in this series, they don't suggest anything. They just show that she's got gray hair, so she's on the older side for having a baby. I don't know. They didn't even say her age. But amazingly, she gets 5 embryos from their one and only shot at IVF, apparently because she's a school teacher and they can't afford multiple rounds.
And ironically, gray hair is in among young women now. But yeah, that's definitely a great number that I feel may be unrealistic for her age, 5 and 1 there. But I think this was before the age, well, it definitely was before the age of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and certainly before it became mainstream, which would become important for patients with higher risks of genetically abnormal embryos, including older women, older donors. But then what do? And young Phoebe, who agrees to be their surrogate, they transfer all 5 embryos at once. And so, yeah, that does seem crazy because most of us know now that usually one embryo transfer is really all that's recommended, except with some very rare exceptions to reduce the risks of high order multiples. But even compared to the ASRM guideline that came out in 2021, transferring 5 embryos isn't that far-fetched maybe in this situation because of the increased risk of pregnancy loss due to genetic abnormalities with her increased maternal age. So they actually say, this is from ASRM, patients 41 to 42 years of age should plan to receive no more than 4 untested cleavage stage embryos or three blastocysts. In women over 43, there are insufficient data to recommend a limit on the number of embryos to transfer when the patient uses her own oocytes. So if we think Phoebe's sister-in-law and friends was at least 43 years old, and they certainly were, at that point, untested embryos, then five embryos might still have been the best choice for her, even if you asked an REI today.
Yeah, I know that it was extreme, probably for the entertainment value, but it's interesting that is still medically legitimate, at least with the appropriate counseling, I'd say. So we'll give friends that one, that they were actually not misrepresenting that part. But still, it goes on. So Phoebe comes back home after her embryo transfer, and that same day goes straight to the bathroom, takes a pregnancy test, and immediately finds out it's positive.
Wow.
Like an hour or something after her embryo transfer. So that is false. That's totally false. And then soon enough, I don't know, is it within the same 20-minute episode or the next one, we find out it's triplets. Because of course, she got five embryos. And then she goes on to have, basically, she's full term, but she doesn't look huge. She looks like she's carrying one baby, but she's full term with three babies. And she has an uncomplicated vaginal delivery of all three babies, and they're all healthy. So yeah, so somewhere along the way, I think the grand total sum of this is, if this is what most of Americans were watching and this is their idea of IVF, that's not how it goes.
Well, and triplet vaginal delivery is something we haven't practiced in over 100 years, yeah. Except in rare accidents. But we probably should have given a spoiler alert if anybody else is binge watching Friends out there, you younger kids.
Yeah, sorry if we've ruined the show for anyone, but you can see how people would get some outlandish ideas about IVF.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely not the only pregnancy or fertility-related misrepresentation in Friends, and we could do probably three seasons on media or entertainment misrepresentations of pregnancy, but we'll not do any more spoilers. We may lose listeners who value their entertainment.
Fair enough. So let's get into how IVF really goes or how it really should go, and we can include some variations of what can happen and maybe a little history for context. I did multiple rotations through infertility in training, and that included sort of shadowing, at least in making IVF treatment plans and egg retrievals and embryo transfers. But the stakes are just so high, and there's just so much technical thought and planning, and so much that an OBGYN resident doesn't know that they don't know, that the only people that should be in the driver's seat and really making the decisions there should be the REI trained physicians or the people in fellowship training.
You were interested in that potentially as a career too.
I was. It's fun to get into the weeds with the biochemical pathways and how one little tiny tweak here makes just a life-changing difference. I think that's pretty neat, but there were not enough spots for me when I applied, so I left it at that, and I'm happy where I'm at.
Well, to be fair, I think I remember you liked every subspecialty enough to want to specialize in it. So it sounds like you're geeking out. But it's just that your branch of the military often had no spots to offer for some of those programs, right?
Yeah, I guess if I had been in a civilian program where all the options were available and then I wanted to do each of them, that might have actually been a problem. So I guess it all worked out for the best. But all that's to say that I really do respect and admire this field, as hard as it is to go through IVF as a patient. I think it's an amazing option for infertile people to have.
Agreed. And our third co-host agrees that IVF's a good thing too. So, all right. Well, how should IVF go?
Well, so as you mentioned, you have to be the right patient. Nobody should be doing this electively. It's very costly. It's very invasive. So
you're saying perfectly fertile couples shouldn't be doing this just to choose maybe the gender of their baby.
Right. Even if they could afford to, they shouldn't. Now, I've been asked that question by patients before. They have two boys, they want a girl. Can you refer me to IVF? So that might be a more common desire than we might think. But I think we mostly know that just for the sole purpose of choosing the sex of their future baby, that is not an indication for IVF. It's not part of our thought process for who we should refer for IVF. And I think there's probably no place in the world where it costs more to go through IVF than in the United States, although some people on the right insurance plans can get at least some coverage, but it's never free for anybody. If the patient doesn't pay, somebody else is paying. So not only should it not be done electively, it probably also shouldn't be done for those cases that are so such bad infertility that it's potentially futile to do the treatment.
Yeah, sort of the other end of the spectrum. And I think that's fairly standard. So once a woman is over a certain age or given a certain AMH level, things like that, you can reliably predict the chance of her being able to produce enough eggs in response to the gonadotropin cycle is exceedingly low or approaching zero. And she probably shouldn't be offered treatments that depend upon that. Most clinics will have an upper age limit cutoff, although it may be different if they're planning to use previously frozen eggs or embryos. So we're assuming that you need to harvest your own. But beyond those two obvious exclusions that are based on the principles of medical justice and non-maleficence, there's a lot of gray areas in who should qualify for IVF. So some examples might be, how high risk are they for pregnancy complications? Should someone with severe hypertension, or they already have stage 4 kidney disease, should they be eligible for IVF treatment? Or what about someone with a BMI greater than 60? Or what about someone with a history of child abuse? So there aren't universal exclusions, although locally you might see practices that have some pre-drawn boundaries and answers to some of these questions.
Yeah, and as in child abuse, as in the patient was the abuser.
Right, correct.
Yeah. So yeah, lots of possible exceptional cases. So I think just for our purposes today, let's try to stick with someone who is as far as much in the green zone as possible, not a gray area. This is someone who's obviously a good candidate and has a good indication, and we'll just take them forward as a hypothetical IVF patient and go through that process.
Sure. And even though it's not obviously one size fits all, people have lots of different histories and stories that get them to this point. But if we want to pretend that there is the quintessential perfect IVF candidate, then it might be one of these patients or one of these scenarios, assuming that these patients are otherwise fairly healthy and don't have contraindications to successful pregnancy. So someone who's seeking to preserve her fertility by having gametes collected and frozen, for example, a reproductive age female who doesn't anticipate natural conception for many years, doesn't have a partner, etc. Or maybe a woman who has both fallopian tubes blocked, or a woman who has patent tubes but has failed less invasive fertility treatments and has sort of unexplained infertility for some specified amount of time or attempts. Many U.S. IVF clinics will say that after 3 failed intrauterine inseminations, you should go on to in vitro. But remember, in the long run, the most cost-effective strategy is actually up to 2 years of using less invasive treatments before starting IVF. We talked about that before in episode 3 of the fertility series. Or another scenario might be a couple who's wanting to proceed with fertility as soon as possible due to a new cancer diagnosis in either one of them, and maybe that involves freezing sperm or eggs so as not to delay treatment. Or a couple where the male has very little sperm, so not enough to make intrauterine insemination effective, but maybe enough for an IVF cycle or for ICSI, or intracytoplasmic sperm injection. Or maybe a couple is seeking a gestational carrier because they have one of those reasons like Phoebe's sister-in-law where they can't physically carry the pregnancy themselves. Or a couple with some serious genetic problems that they want to be able to test for and select out of their future pregnancies, where pre-implantation genetic diagnosis makes a lot of sense.
Okay, yeah. So lots of very different scenarios and reasons for going to IVF. Lots of diversity there. And that list very likely doesn't even cover them all, but it's a good start. So how it should go in a nutshell is that at the start of a patient's cycle, menstrual cycle, or whenever she stops birth control, the patient who's going to have eggs removed and, or let's pretend these are going to be the same person, eggs removed and an embryo implanted in her uterus, she gets a bunch of meds to hyperstimulate her ovaries far more than would happen naturally with her own gonadotropins. If you asked me to intuitively come up with the dosing on my own, I'd have no idea where to start. But this is what's been figured out by research and
trial
experience.
And error.
Yeah, really. So one example of a dosing regimen would be 200 units of recombinant FSH and 75 units of Menopur. So that's FSH plus LH every day. And that's a little injection under the skin. Then she'd have a baseline ultrasound at the very beginning of this process. And then every few days or so while on the meds, just to monitor how the ovaries are responding and how the follicles are growing. And then based on the ultrasound progression, the med dosing will get adjusted up or down as needed. Overall, this should take something like maybe 10 days of meds. And the follicles should all be growing at the same pace. Sometimes they don't, but in the ideal situation, they do. And as they all grow together, they're increasingly putting out more and more estrogen. And then once enough of them get to a certain size, they're going to be ready for collection. I want to say about 16 millimeters. That might vary based on the provider's discretion. But once they get to that specific size, then they're done with the stimulation meds. They're given a shot to trigger ovulation. And this is going to mimic the natural LH surge. And what that does is it triggers those follicles to start going through meiosis II and mature. They don't actually want the eggs to ovulate out of the ovaries into the body because then you can't collect them. So they're going to be collected about 36 hours after this trigger shot with a needle through the vagina under ultrasound guidance. And it's going to go one by one, poke the ovaries, pull out the follicles, and what I learned the hard way is that some clinics will make you do a bowel prep because when they're planning to put a needle in your pelvis multiple times, I guess they want your bowels to be empty and out of the way and not to get poked or to obscure anything. So anyway, that was a fun fact. But the egg retrieval is done under sedation, like a colonoscopy would be done. The embryologist is in the room, and as soon as the eggs are being pulled out with the needle, the embryologist is right there sorting out. They can see which ones are mature in meiosis II and which ones are not. And assuming the plan is to fertilize immediately instead of freezing those eggs, then they'll start fertilizing those mature eggs. And that means they can either put them together in a dish next to the sperm and then let the sperm kind of swim and do its thing, or they can take the sperm and inject it into the egg. And that's an intracytoplasmic sperm injection, or ICSI. Overall, whichever method is chosen is supposed to have a similar success rate, but usually the ICSI is favored for male factor issues. And sometimes for unknown reason, either one of those specific methods might fail. So it's not uncommon for clinics to just split the difference and use both methods in the first round. So take half of the eggs and just put them in the dish next to the sperm and take the other half and inject the sperm in. So that might be getting a little bit semantic or technical, but they can use that information in the future rounds. If both of them succeed just as well, then you just do the less invasive one next time. Anyway, the patient has her eggs extracted, and then the embryologist is working with them. The patient wakes up, she goes home a few hours later and relaxes. The next day, the embryologists will see how many of those eggs actually got fertilized. Even when the sperm is injected straight into the egg, it's rarely, if ever, 100% that they still got fertilized. There's still a lot of work that the egg has to do, even with the sperm already inside of it, to make their DNA combine. And sometimes it's a pretty big drop-off from how many eggs were extracted that were mature to how many on day one are fertilized and become embryos. So then the embryologist just continues to watch the fertilized eggs each day. And often from day to day, there's more drop-off here where eggs got fertilized but then stopped growing. And usually there's no obvious reason they can point to as to why. And whatever embryos make it to day five are then going to be ready either for implantation or biopsy and or freezing. Day five isn't exactly set in stone. They can be implanted a little bit earlier too, or even a little bit later, but day five is pretty average, pretty standard. Any embryo getting biopsied does have to get frozen. You can't just biopsy an embryo on day five and then immediately implant it. It takes 2 weeks or so for the results to come back. But for patients who are not doing the biopsy, they're not doing any genetic testing, they can proceed with implantation during that first week of their egg retrieval. All of those hormones have made their uterine lining thick, and that's optimal for implantation. So they'll just go ahead in that same cycle and have an embryo transfer. But for those who wait for the biopsy results, they have to wait a while. They have to wait for their period, maybe go back on birth control pills while they're waiting for the biopsy results, maybe. And then after that, they get started with a new different med regimen just to thicken up their uterine lining and prevent new ovulation. And that gap between the egg retrieval and getting an embryo transfer later on can be as small as a few weeks or 2 months or more. It just depends on how the clinic groups or treatments and what else has to be done. Then after the embryo transfer, they just sit there and hope that the implantation succeeds.
That is quite a big nutshell. That's yeah. That's the coco de mer, the sea coconut. They weigh up to 65 pounds. There's the trivia for the day, the world's largest nut. You might also be the world's largest nut. Anyway, even so, you did have to leave a lot of details out, or that would be a bit longer. A lot of technical details in all of that. A lot of things that were figured out by trial and error over many years. But that definitely makes it more apparent just how many steps have to all succeed, even in natural fertility, let alone in vitro, for someone to successfully conceive and then ultimately give birth. The egg development, the ovulation, the fertilization, the growth to day 5 or 6, the subsequent implantation in the right environment awaiting it. So many potential points of failure that not even reproductive endocrinologists honestly have figured it all out yet. But I wanted to run through some average rates of success for each of those steps in vitro. They might not mirror the rates of success for the corresponding steps in natural fertility because we're artificially manipulating everything in an IVF cycle. And you're doing this in the context of a person who maybe has pre-existing reasons to not make pregnancy that successful. But it can at least give some insight into what patients can expect if they're undergoing in vitro. And obviously, these numbers vary dramatically depending on a whole lot of factors. But most studies find an average of about 10 or 11 eggs are retrieved per stimulation cycle. It can go as low as 0. It can go as high as 50 or higher. A 2013 study looked at how much we should be aiming for in terms of egg numbers, and more isn't necessarily better. They found that the highest clinical pregnancy rates were found when at least 10 eggs were retrieved, without really any major gains beyond 10. And actually, just in the age groups of 35 to 39, having slightly less eggs seemed to be better in that study. So 5 to 9 was maybe better than 10 or more. But the range of pregnancy rate per IVF cycle went from 11%, that was for women over 40 with 4 or less eggs retrieved, up to 44% for women under 35 with at least 10 eggs retrieved. And I believe this is referring to the total eggs retrieved. So roughly 20-30% of those are often not mature for fertilization, which means that despite the trigger, they don't make it into metaphase 2. There is something called in vitro maturation, in which they allow the immature egg to develop to maturity in the lab setting, but that's still essentially an experimental procedure and isn't widely available.
So yeah, those numbers tell us a few things. Firstly, that even under the best case scenario, which would be a patient with a lot of eggs, they are more likely than not to have to go through more than one IVF cycle, especially if they want more than one baby. But even just for one baby, they might have to go through multiple egg retrievals. And secondly, even when it seems grim, like only one egg retrieved, there's still more than a 10% chance that that one egg will make it and the patient can have a baby. Of course, egg retrieval is just the first of many steps. The eggs, now, they can get frozen if the patient isn't ready to have them fertilized. They don't have the sperm ready or some other reason. But when they do that, only about 75% of frozen eggs will be viable to even attempt fertilization once they're later thawed. So an unfertilized egg thawing out has less of a chance of making it than a fertilized egg. If you fertilize them and then on day 5 freeze them and then thaw them out later, those ones have something much higher, over 95% of those will survive the thawing. So going step by step, let's say someone has 10 eggs retrieved for an IVF cycle because that's the optimal number. And let's say 8 of those eggs are mature. So how many of those 8 mature eggs can we expect to get fertilized? There's been a lot of studies on different types of subpopulations, and the studies on the advanced maternal age patients, so people over 35, show generally about 70% of mature eggs will get fertilized, regardless of the fertilization method. It may be a little higher for younger patients, but in our hypothetical scenario, let's go with 70%. And so that'll give us from 10 eggs retrieved, about 5 or 6 eggs got fertilized.
It's sure easy to understand the anxiety that a lot of IVF patients feel just thinking about the numbers, and these percentages are not amazing. But these are just averages, so there's a wide variety of extremes on both ends, although it's not necessarily a perfectly bell-shaped curve either. But anyway, let's keep going. So you got 10 eggs, let's say we started with, 8 matured, 5 were fertilized. So moving on with the numbers game, how many of those 5 fertilized eggs will progress to day 5 or maybe day 6 or 7 blastocysts that are ready to be implanted? That is also a widely varying number that depends on a lot of factors, especially and obviously the patient's age, but a high percentage is considered 2/3. So that would give us only 3 or 4 blastocysts out of those 10 eggs. Now, the patient may proceed with a fresh transfer right on day 5 from one of those, or freeze them for later transfer, especially if they want genetic testing first and need to await biopsy results.
So if she does biopsy and freeze those 3 or 4 blastocysts, anywhere from 30 to 60% of them would result as euploid. Again, that's a rough average. So now, optimistically, we're down to 2 euploid embryos out of the 10 eggs we started with. But the pre-implantation genetic testing for aneuploidy is surprisingly limited. I think a lot of people may not realize this. They consider it definitive because it's a biopsy, so they think it must be similar to an amniocentesis or a chorionic villus sampling, but it is not. It can detect difference in the number, the relative number of chromosomes. So if there's 2 each of 23 chromosomes, except for 1, it can detect the relative difference. But if there's the same number of all of them, even if it's triploidy or tetraploidy, it'll say the result is normal. Won't detect that there's too many of all of them or too few of all of them. It'll only detect the relative differences in the number of chromosomes. It also can detect mosaicism, but it can't tell you much about the implications or the outcomes of that mosaicism. So you won't know if it's going to be confined just to the placenta or maybe just a small percentage of the fetal cells that won't even be enough to cause disease, or whether the embryo would fully manifest that aneuploidy. But regardless, most clinics, like I said, they'll have a policy up front that if before you even go through the egg retrieval, you'll know up front that any abnormal result will be discarded. This is going to vary based on clinics, but I think they often will try to take away the pressure of making a decision once you're faced with it.
Yeah, and the process itself is subject to error. So sometimes they'll come back with no result or something that would require the patient to decide whether to rethaw and then rebiopsy and then refreeze to do a repeat test or just go some other route with those embryos. So all that then gets us 1 or 2 euploid embryos. And then there's a 95% successful thaw rate for when we choose to reimplant. And you can see the benefit there of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is that we have maybe doubled the chance if we do that we're going to implant a chromosomally normal embryo. So that then subsequently cuts down on your miscarriage rate as well as your successful implantation rate and obviously your healthy live birth rate.
Yeah, and those rates, once you've done the testing, you've gotten a euploid result, which again, it could actually be a hidden tetraploidy or triploidy, but that the result, it says euploid. So taking all that into consideration, the rates of implantation are just under 70% for a euploid result. For an untested embryo, you have to consider all the embryos that made it to day 5, whether or not they're aneuploid. Of course, aneuploid embryos are less likely to implant, and they are also more likely to miscarry if they do implant. But the implantation rate alone without testing per embryo transfer is probably closer to 20%. And this is going to vary, of course, by maternal age, because the older she is or the higher risk of aneuploidy she has, then the lower chance she has of being.
And some of that residual lack of implantation or miscarriage rate is due to the undetected triploidies or tetraploidies. It's not like those result in ongoing pregnancies or successful pregnancies. Mm-hmm. So doing that will definitely double or so your chance that this particular cycle will work out. And that factors into the cost analysis because you're probably into paying for one cycle less on average if you do the testing. Mm-hmm. So it makes some financial sense. Now, there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2021 that argued that overall, if a young patient who's otherwise healthy has about 20 eggs retrieved and ends up with at least 3 normal appearing embryos at day 5, her chance of a live birth will be the same with or without the embryo testing. But that's per the whole cycle, not per individual embryo transfer. So remember that in some cases, the patient has to pay separately for each embryo transfer, and each failed transfer can be emotionally and physically taxing in its own right. So we care not just about the overall chance of pregnancy from an IVF cycle, but about the chance of success for each transfer. In other words, in that scenario, they're allowing her to have the miscarriage or the misimplantation. And as long as you put, you know, three back, you're going to get a baby. But she might have been spared some of that. And by the way, in that study, the patients on average went from 20 eggs retrieved to having 7 normal-looking embryos on day 5, of which 70% were euploid. So back to our hypothetical patient who will have only 2 euploid embryos after a retrieval of 10 eggs. If they were identified as euploid by testing, then they each have almost a 70% chance of implantation. If she didn't do the testing, she has maybe 4 normal-looking embryos that each have less than a 30% chance of implantation. And after successful implantation of a euploid embryo, the miscarriage rates on average will be something like 12 to maybe 25%, depending on some patient factors that include BMI and endometrial thickness and some other things. So I know we've had to piece these numbers together from different sources and different studies, and it seems like there are some inconsistencies, but these final pregnancy and live birth rates we're coming up with don't support the first study we brought up that said that 10 eggs is enough, and even 5 to 9 eggs were optimal in the 35 to 39 age group. But that was a subset of that paper, so take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I think instead of working backwards from the miscarriage and implantation and euploidy rates and so on to determine how many eggs are enough, or even what's the maximum, like should we have an upper limit of how many eggs we should be going for, I think it seems fair to make the argument that we should be going for as many eggs as possible, because there's so many possible points of failure that, and especially when IVF is so expensive, you don't want to put someone through more than that than they have to. They could start off with a lot of eggs and then still end up with almost none by the time they get to the embryo transfer step. So at least for the patient, and maybe also for the provider, I would imagine the reassurance they can gain from going into an embryo transfer knowing that if this one doesn't implant or even if it miscarries, we don't have to go through the whole process again just because we got that optimal 10 eggs. I don't think that would be necessarily as good as saying we got 20 or...
Well, and a lot of couples are wanting more than one child out of it too. Yeah. So it'd be nice if all they had to do was unthaw a healthy embryo 2 or 3 years later and implant it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that definitely can set people up though for the... There are risks of having too many eggs. There's the obvious risks of not having enough eggs is that you went through the whole thing and there's no baby on the other side. No, you don't want that. If you're going through IVF, you're going through it for a baby. But there are risks of having too many eggs too. So it's a tricky balance. But we should talk about some of those risks. I think we've got a little time.
I think you're
here.
Biased. But yes, there definitely are risks of overstimulating patients to get those extra eggs, and on multiple levels, really. But I'll let you start with the one that you're thinking of, OHSS or ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome.
Yeah. So OHSS. There are case reports of it happening naturally outside of the setting of exogenous gonadotropins, but it's almost exclusively an iatrogenic condition that's caused by the IVF process. So even in those natural cases, there's usually some underlying hormonal pathology, because that does not happen with a normal menstrual cycle. But of course, infertility clinics are well aware of this complication. They're very familiar with the signs and how to manage it. Once they've gone and poked multiple holes in someone's ovaries and retrieved as many eggs as they can, all of those puncture sites are going to ooze blood and fluid into the patient's pelvis. And that happens for every IVF patient. But for the patients who were lucky to have a strong response, have lots of eggs to develop and lots of eggs to extract and all those extra needle pokes in their ovaries, all of that extra estrogen that was synthesized by their ovaries, they're at risk of basically the stimulation process continuing even after the retrieval is over. The ovaries can basically keep working as if they're still trying to grow even more follicles. So they're generating all this fluid and it's all just continuing to spill into the abdomen and the ovaries keep swelling up.
Yeah, that's probably a good simplification. Physiologically, of course, it's a little bit more complicated. It's not just fluid coming out of the ovaries, but in response to the high estrogen and HCG levels, as well as other ovarian substances, the whole vascular system becomes leaky and starts spilling fluid out of the bloodstream into the tissues, and mainly the ovaries and abdominal cavity are affected, as you said.
Yeah, it's all, I think, pretty fascinating. But you can imagine the symptoms of that, that the patient's going to get very swollen throughout her whole body, but mainly her abdomen. She's going to get hemoconcentrated with all of that fluid leaking out of her blood vessels. Her electrolytes will be off. And, you know, that they're going to tell every single patient, just drink tons of Gatorade because they know the electrolytes are going to be a little bit off. And for mild OHSS, eventually the HCG and the estrogen levels will decrease. And maybe within about a week, all of that fluid that spilled into the abdominal cavity and the tissues are going to get reabsorbed. And then she'll go to the bathroom and she'll pee all of it out. And then she'll feel a lot better. But with moderate and especially severe or critical OHSS, the process will just keep getting worse and worse. And ultimately, people can get thromboembolism, venous and arterial, pulmonary edema, abdominal compartment syndrome, kidney failure, and other organ dysfunctions, and people can die. So the only modern case reports that I've found of death from OHSS have been in lower income countries where I'm not sure if they take the same precautions against OHSS as they do in the United States and other developed countries.
Yeah, and we hadn't brought that up, but obviously we're well aware of this and REIs do their best to protect against it. So most IVF stem cycles in the United States will include something to counteract the excessive production of estrogen and also prevent the smaller egg follicles from kicking into high gear too once the larger ones have been identified on ultrasound and retrieved. So this might include letrozole or a GnRH antagonist during stimulation and leuprolide with a trigger shot. And at least the letrozole is very easy to continue after retrieval to keep the estrogen from creeping up higher. This is all to prevent ovarian hyperstimulation without compromising the number of good eggs retrieved. So you have some experience with moderate OHSS. What's it like?
Sure. Well, I guess I had a few of the risk factors for that, but I was on those antagonists during and after my treatment cycle that I had recently. And beforehand, I maybe naively assumed that being on those antagonists would completely prevent any and all OHSS. I thought I was on a preventative thing. So I went back to work the next day after my egg retrieval and it's just a little bloated. But over the rest of the week and the weekend, just got more and more uncomfortable. And by 1 week out, I was struggling to eat or drink anything because I'd get these severe abdominal pains whenever I tried to swallow anything besides water or broth. So I just had water and broth. They kept telling me to drink Gatorade and I couldn't even do that. And I kept gaining weight because my bloating was getting way out there. I was looking pregnant, feeling very weak, like getting out of breath and going up the stairs, and figured it's just because I wasn't eating. And I figured this will all turn around soon. So I just got to keep pushing.
You looked bigger than Phoebe did with triplets at term.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And eventually by 1 week out, I realized I'm waiting for this to happen. It's going to go away on its own. But right now, I cannot stand up to do a C-section, or I can't walk back and forth through clinic patients all day without passing out. So I got impatient and even had to ask people to cover for me, which you don't really take that lightly. And I think in our profession, just stepping out of work unscheduled. So I went back to the clinic and begged for them to do something. And this was a very mild to moderate case. I was only a little bit hemoconcentrated, but I did have 3 liters of fluid in my abdomen that they pulled out and then felt better almost immediately.
How many eggs did you get?
40. It was over 40.
So sounds fun. I guess if you have another cycle, you'll have one more risk factor for ovarian hyperstimulation.
Yeah. Yeah. Because having had it previously is a risk factor for having it again. So I'm definitely going to have that foreknowledge going for me if I do this next time. And before I had, when I was walking around with that 3 liters, I did say, I'm never going to do this again. This is a deal breaker. It felt pretty bad. But then as soon as I got treated and I felt better, yeah, I think I'd be fine doing it again now.
Well, I can post a link to an article that discusses the various categories of ovarian hyperstimulation, but I'll read off a list of some of the criteria for severe, because it does get worse, and critical hyperstimulation. So in addition to the nausea, discomfort, enlarged ovaries, and the ascites that you describe that you see in mild to moderate OHSS, with severe to critical, you can also get very significant hemoconcentration. So your hematocrit will go above 55%, your white count will be above 25,000, your creatinine greater than 1.6, elevated liver enzymes, an impaired creatinine clearance, just profound abdominal pain, cardiac arrhythmias, massive hydrothorax, pericardial effusions, you can develop ARDS, and you can become septic. So yeah, it's good to utilize antagonists, especially in someone with risk factors for ovarian hyperstimulation, but it's also good to try to limit the degree of stimulation in the first place and the number of follicles if possible. So this article says 18 or more follicles is a predictor for severe ovarian hyperstimulation, and you had over 40. So this is the other side, obviously, of how many you should go for, and I think where that sort of 10 or so conservative metric is there to try to limit how often we see this. But these are just the immediate downsides. Now, once you get past the possibility of ovarian hyperstimulation, if you're lucky to have a lot of embryos, let's say you get enough that even with testing, you've got 10 euploid embryos, that's great, right? Except that even with some of them not implanting or miscarrying, that could still be more babies than you wanted to have or were safely able to carry given your age or something like that. So now you'd be in the position of deciding to either give away your embryos through embryo adoption, which could be a wonderful thing, obviously, for couples who can't have babies of their own because they don't have the gametes to provide, or of allowing those embryos to perish.
Yeah. So that's definitely a heavy thing to consider. It's hard to really relate to that until it's your own embryos and you're deciding your fate. Yeah. But yeah, overall, from the outsider's perspective, I think in summary of what we've just talked about, it may seem like if you don't know the numbers game and everything, it may seem like you can have almost total control of exactly what kind of baby you get and how many and when with IVF. But the truth is, it's still mostly out of control. So plus all the cost and all the stress.
Very expensive.
So yeah, just think about that next time you have a IVF patient, what they've gone through or what someone's asking for a referral to IVF. What are they asking for? Well, I think we've almost used up most of our time. There are still lots of controversial topics and nuances and protocols, things that vary from clinic to clinic and add-on therapies that you see some clinics offering. We talked about some of those things previously in our fertility episodes before. So this today just becomes part four of that series. Why don't you give us a little quick historical tidbit related to IVF before we quit our episode today?
Well, the history of IVF, I think, is generally well known. It's one of those things that gets covered by the regular media, maybe more so than other medical history because it's recent. So most folks have heard of Louise Brown, who was the first child born on July 25th, 1978, as a result of IVF conception. And I was 3 months old at the time. I had nothing to do with it. But obviously, that wasn't too long ago because I'm a young man. This was the result of the work of British physicians Patrick Steptoe and Robert Edwards. They were OBGYNs who had spent 10 years at that point working on in vitro. Patrick Steptoe is also equally well known for massive amounts of contributions he made to laparoscopy and modernizing that. And laparoscopy was a big part of this because they did this in an age where there were no ultrasounds. So these egg retrievals and even some of the embryo transfers were done using laparoscopic surgery when we didn't have transvaginal ultrasound to guide needles and things like that. So a lot of things that went into that, and Patrick Steptoe made enormous contributions to laparoscopy. Now, the two men had actually achieved an IVF pregnancy in 76, but it was an ectopic pregnancy. So anyway, successful IVF pregnancies followed all around the world in the next few years right after 78. And I think that part of the history is well known. But the research on this and the progress goes back quite a bit further. The first actually implanted pregnancy that was a product of an in vitro cycle, we think, was achieved in 1973 in Australia by Drs. Carl Wood, John Leighton, and Alan Trounson. But that resulted in a miscarriage. And a U.S. physician named Landrum Shettles actually set out to perform IVF in this country in 1973 and might have been successful, but his department chair at the very last minute stopped him from doing it. There was, as you can imagine, a lot of politics and ethical discussions going on in that era about embryos and what the implications of IVF cycles would be.
Is that the same Shettles who came up with the Shettles?
It is. Method? It is indeed. So Shettles, among other things, developed GIFT, or gamete intrafallopian transfer. They use laparoscopy for that. And he did a lot of groundbreaking work related to infertility. But unfortunately, he'll probably most be known for the Shettles method. So he wrote a book that sold over 2 million copies that made claims that different sexual positions and timing of intercourse in relation to when you ovulate and things like that could help you select the sex of your child. And a lot of this stuff is still believed. And the book, you can still buy it. Like, I think people are still printing this book. But of course, it's all nonsense.
Well, as I said, I do have patients coming in asking about what they can do to control or choose the sex of their baby.
And you tell them to do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis.
Well, that's the only established way.
Yeah, the Shettle stuff is all over the internet. If you've ever searched for that or read on the internet about sex selection, it comes from Dr. Shettles. But anyway, the interesting part, I think, is the older history of in vitro. So the first embryo transfer was actually done in 1891 by Walter Heap. But this was between an Angora rabbit and a Belgian hare. And that the hare carried the Angoras. And so you could tell that, the transfer was successful because they were different. Now, in 1948, John Rock, along with Miriam Minkin, who was a doctoral student, retrieved over 800 eggs and fertilized 138 of them in vitro. Now, it was actually Miriam Minkin who did this, the fertilization. So she actually gets credit for performing the first in vitro fertilization, literally fertilizing these eggs in a petri dish. John Rock had also been the first person to extract an intact fertilized egg from a human prior to that. So we could do a whole episode on John Rock, just an enormous figure in the modern history of OBGYN and reproductive endocrinology. He's probably the man mostly responsible for the birth control pill, and he got the clinical trials done that brought the birth control pill to market. He did the most important early work on freezing sperm as well. And as I said, he extracted the first fertilized egg and then did these egg retrievals by the hundreds and did the first in vitro fertilization of eggs retrieved from humans, but they never implanted them. Interestingly about John Rock, he was a Roman Catholic, and when developing the birth control pill, he wanted to create a natural method of birth control, and he felt that if he could, the church would approve of it. And since progesterone in the luteal phase naturally prevents conception, then he believed that giving progesterone to prevent conception would be a, quote, natural method that would be compatible with this Catholic faith and with the theology of the Catholic Church. And that's actually where he got the idea to do it this way. So in 1951, Pope Pius XII had sanctioned the rhythm method because it was natural, and Rock had a big interest in that. He ran a clinic in the 1930s specifically to teach Roman Catholics how to use the rhythm method. In his mind, the pill and the rhythm method weren't really different since they both had to do with progesterone. The rhythm method just recognized when the progesterone was high in your body, so you could have sex then and not get pregnant. And the birth control pill let you know that the progesterone was high in your body because it put it there. And in 1958, Pope Pius, the same pope, approved the birth control pill as long as it was primarily being used for something else. So like if you had painful periods or irregular cycles or endometriosis or something like that, and you were using the pill for that, then he was okay as a secondary effect if it prevented pregnancy. This was also one of the main reasons why the pill was designed to give women a period. There have been other reasons, and there was some marketing data that indicated that women would be a little put off if they didn't have their monthly cycle because they felt like at the time culturally that they needed to shed their lining or relieve toxins from the body or something like that. But for Rock, he felt like the church would approve the birth control pill if it gave a naturally occurring or a cycle in the natural time, and it was essentially an extension of the rhythm method. But ultimately, in 1968, a different Pope, Paul VI, outlawed oral contraceptives and other, quote, artificial methods of birth control. And that was, Rock was not happy about that. But anyway, there's a lot of thought about how birth control might have been developed differently if it wasn't for John Rock working so hard to make something he thought the Catholic Church would ultimately approve of. But in any event, John Rock gets most of the real credit for developing all the little parts and pieces that eventually led to successful in vitro and the knowledge of hormones and things like that that ultimately would culminate in the first IVF pregnancy in 1978.
Well, very interesting. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up today. I think we're a little over time, but the Thinking About OBGYN website will have links to articles we talked about today, and be sure to listen in a couple weeks. Send us more emails if you've got something to say, good or bad, or some requests. We've got some good requests lately. Just have to try to work them in. But we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at thinkingaboutobgyn.com. Be sure to subscribe. Look for new episodes every 2 weeks.